Immigration, legal and not, is always a hot topic in America. Hotter still since Donald Trump took office, vowing to build a wall on the Mexican border and otherwise crack down on illegal immigration. The generally agreed upon number of immigrants here illegally is 11 million or more. Of those, perhaps 2.7 million people who grew up here, but not as citizens. They were brought into the country as children. These are the people Roberto G. Gonzalez profiled in large numbers in his book Lives in Limbo, Undocumented and Coming of Age in America. Roberto is an assistant professor at Harvard University Graduate School of Education. His research deals with the factors that promote and impede the progress through school of Latino and immigrant children. Roberto's work appears in science journals. His general interest work has been published in major newspapers and Time magazine, and he slogged through the snow to get to his office in Harvard. Roberto Gonzalez, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Good to have you. So this work is really a write-up of your own research, and it's a long study. How did you get started?
So this is a really long study. I ended up spending 12 years following 150 young people. I first became interested in this population years before in Chicago. Right after college, I worked for several years as a youth worker in Chicago communities, and spending time with kids and their families over the years, started noticing that many of our neighborhood kids, as they hit about 14, 15, 16 years old, as their friends were getting driver's licenses, getting first jobs, after school work, thinking about college, their legal status became a giant barrier for them. So fast forward a few years, and I'm in a graduate program in Southern California, and I start meeting many young people with very similar stories that come to the U.S. at 6 months old, at 2 years old, at 5 years old, had grown up side by side with American-born friends and peers, but again at this critical period as their friends were moving forward, participating in really important and defining American rites of passage, they found themselves stuck. And so this became, this real basic question for me, what happens to these kids as they come of age, really motivated me through these 12 years of research.
It sounds like growing up undocumented in America is rather like being a time bomb. At some point, it's going to explode on you, and your life will change or not change, as the case may be.
Yeah, that's right. I think that what sets in motion this kind of time bomb is that undocumented children are, because of a Supreme Court ruling in 1982 in a case called Plyler versus Doe. Plyler ruled that states could not deny undocumented children access to an education. So as a result of Plyler, very importantly, these kids are powerfully integrated into our K-12 school system. But Plyler didn't address school beyond K-12, and it didn't address life beyond school. So tens of thousands of these young people graduate from American high schools each year, but they do so to uncertain futures. They can't legally work. They can't drive in most states. They're excluded from federal financial aid, and so they at about 15, 16, 17 years old, many of these young people they hit this wall or this time bomb, as you describe.
So you mentioned in Chicago you noticed a split, that some young people got help and others did not. Could you figure out why some people got help and some didn't?
Yeah, I think that this was more of a general trend, and I think that in many large urban school districts, and this is what I was dealing with in Chicago, and in my LA study, the schools that I sampled from, they were all kind of medium to large size high schools, and what happens oftentimes is that kids are tracked. Kids are tracked into a smaller number of kids are have access to scarce resources via smaller class size, caring teachers, more resources, college visits, while a larger pool of kids are in kind of medium to lower tracks, where class sizes are larger, where they don't have unique access to counselors. In California, the student to counselor ratio is about 950 to 1, and so national average is about 477 to 1. So if you're not in a specialized program, and you don't have a relationship with a teacher, with a counselor, somebody that you could trust, more than likely, if you have problems at home that are related to poverty or, in this case, immigration status, oftentimes those problems don't get detected. So where one is slotted within the school curriculum plays a huge role in terms of the resources they get, in terms of the help that they receive, in terms of really important accesses.
And is it based on any sort of assessments or anything measurable, or is it just like the teachers are you know, feeling like these kids are responding well, and so we're going to give them more help, and these aren't, so they're not?
Well, I think traditionally in this country, we've got programs like Gifted and Talented Program, International Baccalaureate Program. Schools tend to put more resources into these programs so that kids that test well oftentimes have a better offering of the school curriculum and resources.
Okay, more with Roberto Gonzalez about lives in limbo, undocumented and coming of age in America when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Roberto Gonzalez, Roberto G. Gonzalez, an assistant professor at the Harvard University Graduate School of Education. Takes a long look at elements of society. In particular, he spent 12 years talking to 150 people in Southern California who are undocumented. His book is called Lives in Limbo, Undocumented and Coming of Age in America. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Roberto, you talked about getting some early experiences in Chicago before you moved to L.A. to begin studying all the people there. And there's a story in Chicago of a young man named Alex in the book. What happened to him?
Yeah, Alex is a young boy that I met when he was 6 years old. His parents had brought him and his brother from Mexico at age four, and so his mom brought him to our community center where I was working, and enrolled him in our after school program. And Alex, I could tell right away for Alex that he was a very shy kid. He spent most of his days after school on his own, drawing and painting. We could tell very early that Alex had a gift, and over the years, just like we did with other kids, we tried to facilitate this interest. And so we, as a program, we provided art materials, sketch pads, paints, chalks. We helped to enroll him in Saturday and weekend art classes. So by the time Alex was in eighth grade, he had been part of major murals in his community. He had won several art contests, and so we really thought he was this talent was going to really take him a long way. And so we persuaded his parents to consider private art schools for Alex, and we did the difficult work of convincing his parents that he would still be taking a regular curriculum, that he'd be taking history classes and English classes and math classes, but he would also have this unique opportunity to really pursue the arts. So his parents are on board. We had done some fundraising to pay for about a semester. We were hoping that he'd get his foot in the door, and we could then work on scholarships for him. So he gets his application in his eighth grade year, and he takes it home, and he's filling out his application at his kitchen table, and he comes to the part of his application that asks for his Social Security number. And as a 14-year-old, he had never been asked to produce any of to produce a birth certificate or any other legal documents. And so he asks his mom. He says, "Mom, can you get out my paperwork? I'm filling out my application. I need to know my Social Security number." And his mom took what I imagine to be a very long and uncomfortable pause. And when she continued, she told Alex, she said, "Son, you don't have one. You don't have legal status in this country." Her family had come to the U.S. In the wake of the last legalization in the late 1980s, and she thought by the time that this was going to become an issue for her sons, that either they would have had their status adjusted or there would have been changes within our laws. But here they are, Alex, 14 years old, filling out this application, and he's finding out that he doesn't have legal status. And so he calls me, and I bring together some people from the community, and we decide to go to the school. We scheduled a meeting with the admissions office, and we brought his portfolio. And so we're going through his portfolio, some of his paintings that had won art contests, some photos of murals that he had painted within his community. And we're very confident as we're going through this portfolio and discussing Alex with these admissions officers. And then we get a series of questions that we weren't expecting. So what are you saying, that this boy is, in their words, an illegal Mexican? So we say, yes, well, he's undocumented. He does not have legal status in this country. So they ask, how did he get here? How has he been allowed to go to school? Where is his border pass? So we tried our best to answer these questions that we really weren't expecting from educators. And as we were talking, we were interrupted, and one particular admissions person told us, "Well, we cannot consider this boy for admission to our school because, again, in his words, because he's an illegal Mexican." So this was devastating. We had spent all of this time and energy into this really what we felt to be a really important pathway for Alex. And Alex goes from really high hopes to his neighborhood high school, a high school that was graduating at the time about 50% of its freshman class. So Alex is disconnected. He's frustrated. He's angry. He's very disappointed. He starts school, and his first semester, he hits another barrier when he's told that he can't take driver's ed because, as an undocumented immigrant in the state of Illinois, he was not eligible for a driver's license. And then his friends are taking after school jobs, and Alex wants to join them because he wants to have spending money, doesn't want to bother his parents, but he also learns that he can't legally work. So one by one, barriers are erected in front of Alex's pathway for the first time in his young life. And this was really debilitating for Alex, and this is not a happy story. Alex leaves school before his freshman year, and ends up on the street with other young boys who are also out of school, and this for me was a really frustrating experience because I had watched him grow up, I had seen his potential, and then in a very short time. A very, very short time, his life spiraled downward very quickly.
Wow. It's one of many stories in Lives in Limbo, Undocumented and Coming of Age in America. Roberto Gonzalez, its author, our guest on The Exchange. The terms that scholars use for young people without documents is Americans in Waiting, but also impossible subjects. What does that come from, impossible subjects?
Yeah, so these are terms really, I mean, you picked, I think, two really good ones, Americans in Waiting, that for all intents and purposes, these are young people who are American, that they've grown up in this country. Many of the young people that I met grew up to Barney and the Power Rangers. They did everything in childhood that their friends were doing. They lived a childhood in lockstep fashion with their friends. But again, at this critical time, they find themselves unable to move forward, and really this impossibility of membership for them, this all-elusive citizenship for them is really then becomes only a dream, or as many of the young people that I met referred to as a nightmare. A young man named Rudy described this very aptly. He said that at around 16 years old, he awoke to a nightmare. We think about all of this kind of these dream metaphors, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream, Langston Hughes' Harlem when he poses the question, what happens to a dream deferred? This American dream that for teachers, that teachers and other adults in kids' lives encourage young people to dream, that if they work hard, if they dream boldly enough, that they can achieve something. But for many of these young people, this dawning of adolescence really is tantamount to a waking nightmare where their worlds turn upside down.
And so, as you write, illegality becomes their master status. It just looms above everything else.
Yeah, this master status, this is an old sociological concept that basically refers to a particular trait that overwhelms all other traits or experiences. People tend to think about race and gender, for example, as master statuses. Here I'm arguing that for these young people, that illegality, that undocumented status, the life of an undocumented young person, that this is their master status, that no matter how quickly these young people may come out of the gate, no matter what their initial advantages might be, that over time, here's this master status, or this a lead weight, if you will, that eventually drags them down. It's something that shapes perceptions of them. It's something that it's their primary legal characteristic determining their access and rights. It's something that in adolescence and adulthood constrains most of their actions and most of their decisions. And it has a leveling effect in the long term.
Our guest on the Jefferson Exchange is Roberto Gonzalez. He's an assistant professor at the Harvard University's Graduate School of Education. He tracked 150 undocumented young people in Southern California for 12 years and has written up his results in the book Lives in Limbo, Undocumented and Coming of Age in America. This is not one of these full of facts and figures kind of books so much as it is stories from the individuals that he talked to and got to know over time. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I got curious while we were talking about Alex back in Chicago, and the fact is that the state of Illinois is now one of 12 plus D.C. that allow driver's licenses on a temporary basis for undocumented people, but many years later, after Alex was first trying to get one. Which gets us to a very basic question, Roberto. I mean, if people are here without legal status, how does the broader society benefit from eventually conferring legal status of some kind?
Yeah, this is a really good question. And the question really, I think, gets to the heart of this matter, and that is that we educate these children in our public schools. These kids are our neighbors. They're the friends of our kids. They're in our churches, and I think importantly, These kids are young people who want to contribute, who want to lead full lives. But by stunting their growth, we limit not only their potential, but we also limit their potential contributions to our communities and to our society. That if these young people are aspiring to careers in medicine or careers in law, careers in architecture, careers in city, county, state, or even federal government, that without a remedy, we not only fail them, but we lose out on their potential contributions.
Well, you know, it's not just that you track the 150 people in Southern California over those 12 years. There's a good history lesson provided in here as well about many years of Mexican laborers coming over the border. Have been several bits of federal legislation through decades past. It seems like none ever stopped the flow of immigrants, and it sounds like it was because nobody really wanted that flow to stop.
Yeah, that's correct. And we're talking about probably a 100-year history of Mexican migration to the United States, and this constitutes the longest and largest labor migration stream in the country. And I think that this is an important lesson for how we got here. So we think back historically, Mexican laborers have played a major role in the building of our railroads, in our agricultural industry, in mining, and many occupations or many very important labor sectors within the United States. But in the late 1980s, after our last legalization, the United States began to pour more money into our southern border, building longer and taller and thicker fences, putting more agents on the border, investing money in increased surveillance technology. And so what that did is that it had unintended consequences. So labor demand doesn't stop or doesn't slow down until probably about 2007, 2008, when our economy crashes. But what changes is that it became a lot more difficult, a lot more dangerous, and a lot more costly to cross. So in the decades prior, migrants were coming to the U.S. and leaving their spouses and their children at home. But instead of risking this dangerous, difficult, and costly venture of crossing back and forth, migrants brought their families with them. And so you see in the late 1980s, accelerating through the 1990s, a growing number of settled undocumented immigrants with families who have made the United States their home, and a growing number of children who will grow up in this country without legal status.
You're saying in previous generations they might have come and gone back and forth across the border and left the family in Mexico?
Exactly. And this is a very, very central to current discussions about a border wall and whether or not that will have any effect. Well, certainly what this does, it does jack up the cost of coming through a smuggler or other means. It does increase the danger. But there's been a very long history, as you mentioned, of labor migration and of industries in this country that rely on cheap, flexible, expendable labor that migrants from Mexico have provided.
Federal laws aside, I mean, you also cite some state laws, including Arizona, which passed a fairly stringent anti-immigration law. Alabama seemed to go a step beyond that a few years ago. Now, the people you followed lived in California, and the state laws even there have oscillated over time, haven't they?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that this really, draws attention to a very important contour of contemporary immigration, and that is in the absence of federal immigration reform, our Congress came close in 2013 to passing a comprehensive immigration reform bill, 2010 to passing a DREAM Act, but still has not. And so, in the absence of federal immigration reform, states, counties, and municipalities have taken upon themselves to address immigration at the local level. And so what we see is that in some places, lawmakers have moved to pass laws that are more integrative. And on the other hand, we have other localities that have passed laws that are more punitive, more enforcement heavy. And so where one lives in the United States today, more so than ever before, is very consequential to their experience of either integration or exclusion.
We'll come back to the people that Roberto Gonzalez got to know in 12 years of study in Southern California, the people he talks about in his book, Lives in Limbo, Undocumented and Coming of Age in America. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join the conversation by phone or by email when we return in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Roberto G. Gonzalez, Harvard University Graduate School of Education, assistant professor. Spent 12 years following 150 of the so-called Dreamers, undocumented young people in Southern California, getting to know their stories regarding immigration and documentation and the lack thereof. The book is called Lives in Limbo, Undocumented and Coming of Age in America. You can join the conversation about a very thorny problem that America is still dealing with. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And it's a problem for, 2.7 million people are in this category, do we believe?
Those are our best estimates, placed in between about 2 and 2.5 million people.
So you do step back from the present to the childhoods of your subjects. I mean, do they, any of them, really remember coming across the border?
Yeah. Many of them have. Some of them have had really vivid memories of crossing. But you know, some of them, as I mentioned, others. Some of them came to the U.S. as early as 6 months old. I met a couple who I think had been. Who had come even earlier than that, maybe 3 or 4 months. Mm-hmm. And so for most of them, their most vivid memories, their strongest attachments were in communities around Los Angeles.
Can they generally remember an age when they thought, oh boy, I could have problems when I get older? Were a lot of them blindsided, like Alex we talked about, who got to 14 and just found out he was undocumented?
Yeah. Probably the majority of the young people that I talked about, that I talked to, did not have any understanding of their immigration status growing up. This was a different time. These are young people growing up in the 1990s. Things look a little different today. But even for the ones who told me that they knew in childhood that they didn't have legal status, it really wasn't until this knowledge of their status was matched with experiences of exclusion that their status really became salient in their lives.
Well, and you come back many times to the concept of deserving and undeserving. Who uses those terms? Is it used within the community or upon the community?
Well, it's usually upon the community, and it's usually teachers. It's also the media. It's politicians. The DREAM Act, the federal DREAM Act, was first introduced in 2001, as a legal pathway for undocumented children. So I mentioned comprehensive immigration reform earlier. So nothing that large, but a small tailored bill that would provide legal access to these young people, and many of the legislators Dick Durbin, Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois, for example. They wanted to craft a policy narrative that was counter to some of the negative stereotypes of Mexican migrants, of undocumented immigrants. And so they crafted this narrative of this innocent child who had achieved a great deal in childhood, who was a class valedictorian, their senior class president, who was a star athlete. And so we got this image of this dreamer that was this superhuman kid who was the best, the very best. And during this study, I met dozens of them, and subsequent to this study, I've met hundreds of these young people. They exist. There are many of these young people who are extremely talented. But this linking deservingness with high achievement does a real disservice, particularly because this is a population that faces a great number of obstacles. These are young people who grow up in low-income households, who face disadvantages because of their parents' legal immigration status, who face the stresses and the strains of seeing their friends move forward while they can't join them, who are compelled nevertheless because of limited family finances to join the labor force, to drive even when they don't have legal authorization to do so. And so when we place these young people into categories of deserving and undeserving, we oftentimes leave out their parents. Their parents, if these kids are the innocent victims of being brought, then their parents are guilty of that. If 5% of them make it to college, then 95% of them end up in low-wage jobs. And so this deserving category is a very small one, or who gets placed into this deserving category is a very, very specific, very homogenous group that over time shrinks. Over time, as I the advantage of doing this longitudinal research is that I saw over time, even those who had done really well had eventually succumbed to the constraints of their status. So in 2012, before DACA was announced, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the Obama program, close to 30 of my respondents had graduated from college with bachelor's degrees. Another dozen had gone on to earn post baccalaureate degrees in law, in education, in social work, and public policy. But none of those young people were in career pathways that matched their educational credentials or training.
So they might as well be immigrants in another country. The stories you hear about so often in America, where people have fled their home countries as refugees and ended up, you know, doctors driving cabs, that sort of thing.
Yes, they look very familiar to those kinds of profiles.
So ultimately, you have a few million people who feel trapped. They have not known anything other than life in America. I mean, and if you want to talk about approaches, well, they could be deported, but they'd be deported to countries they don't know and have never lived in or have any memories of. Or you could make them citizens, but that seems to be a really tough approach right now. How many of the people that you talked to were able to take advantage of DACA?
Yeah, so my book ends shortly after the implementation of DACA in 2012. More than 750,000 young people now have a DACA status, and in the short term, particularly among young DACA beneficiaries, it's had a major effect on their lives. They now have new jobs. They've increased their earnings. They've started to build credit through credit cards, through bank accounts. They have driver's licenses because now all 50 states allow DACA beneficiaries to drive, and many through work and school are getting health care. So it's allowed these young people to take a giant step towards the American mainstream. For many of my respondents, DACA may have come a little too late, and that is that by the time DACA was announced, many of my respondents were in their early to mid-30s. And so many of them didn't make the 31-year, age 31 cutoff. They had aged out of eligibility. Others, because of circumstances involving their status, had committed crimes in adolescence that made them ineligible for the program. And others others who hadn't graduated from college didn't see DACA as improving their lives. A small number of my college-going sample were able to successfully apply and get their DACA, get approved for DACA. And these young people have had mixed results in terms of their ability to take advantage of DACA's offerings.
Let's take a phone call here. We have Greg in Grants Pass on the line, and we're talking to Roberto Gonzalez, the author of Lives in Limbo. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Greg. Good morning. Do I need to turn off my Bluetooth, or can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay. I just wanted to say, you know, these folks who have come here are desperate. Many of them. I remember one day I was coming home from work building a new prison down by Douglas, Arizona, in the early 1980s, now that I remember. And I was feeling sorry for myself. I hated this job. And I saw this, I lived in Naco, which is right on the border, but I saw this couple with two kids, maybe 5 and 6 years old in tow, just running across that no man's land there. They'd gotten across through the fence, which was really not even a fence there at that time. And Dad had a blanket over his shoulder with all their whatever they had in it, and two kids in tow just running. And I thought, man, I thought I was having a bad day. Those poor people are really having a rough time.
All right. Thanks for sharing that story, Greg. Appreciate that. So are these some of the circumstances you heard from? I imagine you talked to the parents of a lot of the people you followed.
Yeah, and this is a tragedy, I think, for many of these young people. I think, and also their parents. I think that undocumented immigrant adults are often vilified in these debates. But I think as the caller, I think less of a question, more of a comment, as his comment, I think, really epitomizes that these are regular people, I think, like you and me, who are leaving desperate situations and hoping to have better lives for their children. And what they confront, I think, once here is they're not only kind of smack dab in the middle of a very hotly contested political debate, but life on the margins is very difficult, and they live very narrowly circumscribed everyday lives that really limit their possibilities.
Another call here from Mark in Reading. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning. Is it legal for these people to become members of the U.S. military, and if so, what percentage of them that you know do?
All right, good question there. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think that's one of the most misunderstood issues. I think that there's a lot of confusion around this. Technically, undocumented immigrants are not eligible for military service. We've seen people get citizenship who entered the military through lawful permanent resident status. So green card holders, for example, are able to serve in our military. But currently, undocumented immigrants, DACA beneficiaries, are not eligible to serve in our military.
Would you characterize the general sense of the 150 people you followed for 12 years as, well, not despair. I mean, it sounds like some of them are doing very well, but how would you characterize that?
Well, I think that, you know, I think that, that for in many ways that that these young people are the embodiment of Langston Hughes's dream deferred. And what I mean by that is that these are young people who at one point in their lives had high hopes to be included, had high hopes to be able to pursue their dreams. When I started out this study, I was interested in mobility pathways among undocumented immigrant youth, largely education and employment. I wanted to understand their trajectories through school and through work. But what I found, in addition to that, what I found overwhelmingly is that the young people that I met spoke of physical and emotional manifestations of stress. They described chronic headaches, toothaches, ulcers, problems getting out of bed in the morning, eating problems. It became very clear to me that there was a very strong link between their undocumented status and their well-being. And so I think that this has been, I think, one of the more important, I think, discoveries through this research that really, I think, that allows us to see the effects, the human toll of our immigration policies.
Well, it is thorough research, 12 years with 150 people. The book is called Lives in Limbo, Undocumented and Coming of Age in America. Roberto Gonzalez, great job on the book, and thanks so much for going through the snow to get to the office in Cambridge today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Jeffrey.
All right, take it easy.